Now, the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
And welcome, everyone, to the Friday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. Yes, we've made it to Friday of this week. I think we all deserve a round of applause. David French of National Review is in for the vacationing Jim Garrity this week. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. And David, a special piece of applause for you, because when I asked you if you could fill in for Jim this week, August 14th through the 18th, this is usually kind of the political dead season. We'd find a story here and there, try to get through the week with interesting stories. Didn't quite turn out that way. This was a very busy week, very eventful week, very difficult week in many different ways. So thank you so much for taking on more intensity this week than you were probably anticipating. But as always, you've done a great job. So thanks for everything.
Well, thanks for having me. And I have to say, I can't remember if he said this yesterday or not. I don't know if Jim is upset that he is on vacation this week or happy that he's on vacation. Maybe a little bit of both.
Probably a little bit of both, yeah. We'll see how much he's actually had to pay attention while on vacation. That's never too much fun. It's more fun to catch up and figure out what you missed. But let's move on to our three martinis today. And David, how appropriate that we're ending this particular week with crazy martinis all the way across the board. Crazy. Crazy and crazy. The first one stems from the horrific Islamic terrorist attack in Barcelona, Spain, and the follow-up attack in the resort village not far from Barcelona. One person dead in the subsequent attack, 14 dead, and about 100 injured at least in the van attack, as the media calls it. But it's a terrorist attack along Las Ramblas in Barcelona, a very popular area. Of course, we've seen this so many different times. We saw it in Nice with the truck attack. We saw it at the Berlin Christmas market last year with many people being killed. We saw it in Stockholm. We've seen it in London. We've seen it in many different places with respect to radical Islam. But apparently, David, CNN's memory is a little bit short. While it's important to point out that that was a terrorist attack that took the life of Heather Heyer in Charlottesville on Saturday, they seem to believe that that's when terrorist attacks by this method perhaps began. Because here is National Security Correspondent Jim Sciutto, followed by Wolf Blitzer, who is really the one who makes this a crazy martini here.
In light of the uproar of the last several days, 5 days apart, you have a white supremacist in Charlottesville use a vehicle to kill, and here you have attackers at least following the modus operandi of terrorists using vehicles apparently to kill as well. And those shared tactics that should be alarming.
Yeah, and there will be questions about copycats. There will be questions if what happened in Barcelona was at all a copycat version of what happened in Charlottesville, Virginia, even though there may be different characters, different political ambitions. They used the same killing device, a vehicle going at high speed into a large group of pedestrians.
Now, David, I've heard from quite a few people that Wolf Blitzer is actually a pretty nice guy, but listening to him in that particular situation and in many others, he's not exactly raising the collective IQ.
This is nuts. I mean, there was copycatting, and it was the alt-right terrorist copying ISIS. That was the copying. ISIS does not take its cues from the American alt-right. I mean, ISIS, they're the Michael Jordan of terrorism. They're the apex predator, so to speak. I mean, they're the paramount threat. This vehicle attack in Barcelona is just one, as you know, as we all know, of many. I mean, ISIS publications have been urging vehicle attacks for a very long time. I mean, we've seen it happen in London. We've seen it happen in Nice. We've seen it happen in Germany. We've seen it happen, heck, in the United States, at Ohio State. We've seen this again and again. This is a signature ISIS attack. To then say that the alt-right in the United States is somehow influential on ISIS is just, I mean, number one, there's no evidence for that at all. And number two, it's dramatically magnifying the influence of the alt-right. It just flat out does not have that influence. ISIS is it's a different beast entirely. They don't belong in the same conversation. I mean, we're talking about a terrorist entity that not only was able to take over a nation state sized chunk of the Middle East, including for a time the city of Mosul in Iraq, still holds Tal Afar in Iraq, still holds most of Raqqa in Syria, infiltrated the great cities of Western Europe. I mean, you just go on and on and on. And to sort of mention them in the same breath as these alt-right terrorists is very, very, very bizarre. And it's it almost feels like an effort to magnify the alt-right, an effort to magnify their threat, when the reality is they're awful, they're loathsome, and in this case they were, one of them was a murderer and a terrorist, but they just don't belong in the same conversation. And that's not to in any way excuse the alt-right. That's not in any way to minimize the alt-right. It's just to speak the truth. It's just to let's keep things in proportion and perspective. I mean, I don't want to bring a Game of Thrones analogy into this. No, wait a minute. I actually do want to bring a Game of Thrones analogy. But it's not all that different in some ways. You know, when we saw this ISIS attack, it reminds me of the episode Hard Home, where Jon Snow sees the Night King and he realizes that there are levels and dimensions of threat out there. This ISIS attack is a reminder that there is still out there on the international stage one of the worst terror organizations that we've seen in living memory. And it's still there, and it's not taking its cues from the American alt-right. It's taking its cues from its own playbook, and its own playbook is vicious and deadly.
It most certainly is. And David, I know you're pretty active on Twitter. I'm guessing you probably follow a guy who goes under the handle of Iowa Hawk Blog.
Yes.
He's one of the funnier folks out there on Twitter. And he's got a couple tweets today that are not only funny, but ought to give folks some pretty good pause. One of them is, please pray for all the victims of Twitter hot take moral whiplash. And then he says, my new fun game, reading what people are saying today about Barcelona and then seeing what they said yesterday about Charlottesville. So what do you make of the way that folks, perhaps from multiple perspectives, have been consistent or inconsistent in the past week?
One of the most tiresome aspects of modern American commentary debate is how everything has to fit a particular narrative. And so for a long time, the narrative about Islamic terror has been, oh, you know, it's not that big a deal. It's less dangerous to Americans than falling in a bathtub. Why are we freaking out so much about it? On and on and on. Minimize, minimize, minimize. In spite of the fact that, you know, if you look at 9/11, it was the most catastrophic attack on United States soil in American history, at least since the burning of our own capital in the War of 1812. You've had thousands of Americans die overseas fighting terrorists, tens of thousands maimed. You know, as I said, you know, the death toll from jihadists overseas in particular is numbered in the hundreds of thousands, with millions of refugees. And we're supposed to be saying, oh, this is just, that's not that big a deal. And then when you see an act of alt-right terror, well, then you're going to be treated to the narrative of, you know, America is in grave danger. These people are more dangerous than jihadists. And you have a distortions of statistics to try to argue that America far-right terrorists are more dangerous than even ISIS or Al-Qaeda. And the narrative is just so ridiculous. Look, you can say, as I just said, you can say what happened in Charlottesville was a horrible act of terror, and that the alt-right is evil and white supremacists are evil, and some of them are violently evil. And then you can also say, but what's far more dangerous than the alt-right to human life at home and abroad and to national security are jihadist terrorists. And you can say that, and it can be absolutely true on both counts, and you're not minimizing or excusing alt-right or white supremacist terror. Thankfully, it is not at the threat level of jihadists. And if it was at the threat level of jihadists, oh my goodness, think about the problem and the crisis we would be in this country.
All right, let's move on to our second crazy martini now. And David, as you have written about, one of the things that needs to be talked about, perhaps not in the way that the president talked about it on Tuesday, but of the problem presented by Antifa, or Antifa, depending on which pronunciation you go with. They're the ones that, of course, trashed UC Berkeley in connection with the Milo Yiannopoulos scheduled speech. They're the ones that ripped up a bunch of downtown Washington, D.C. on Inauguration Day. And there were elements there as part of the counter-protesters in Charlottesville. And, of course, that is some of the elements that those who are defending the president are pointing to as to what he was trying to do there in spreading a little bit of the blame. So now the New York Times has come out with a profile to some extent of Antifa. And this is, first of all, how Ed Morrissey at Hot Air intros it. He says, the New York Times profiles the efforts of Antifa, the rebranding of leftist anarchist provocateurs who have been around in one form or another for as long as the neo-Nazis against which they agitate. Echoing the infamous Vietnam-era quote, it became necessary to destroy the town in order to save it. But without any comprehension of its irony, the current face of Antifa insists that it takes violence to protect nonviolence. Here's the actual quote. Unlike most of the counter-demonstrators in Charlottesville and elsewhere, members of Antifa have shown no qualms about using their fists, sticks, or canisters of pepper spray to meet an array of right-wing antagonists whom they call a fascist threat to American democracy. As explained this week by a dozen adherents of the movement, the ascendant new right in the country requires a physical response. Quote, people are starting to understand that neo-Nazis don't care if you're quiet or you're peaceful, said Emily Rose Nauert, a 20-year-old Antifa member who became a symbol of the movement in April when a white nationalist leader punched her in the face during a melee near the University of California, Berkeley. Quote, you need violence in order to protect nonviolence, Ms. Nauert added. That's what's very obviously necessary right now. It's full-on war, basically, unquote. David, what do you make of the clear logical disruption in the mind of Ms. Nauert and many others on the Antifa movement?
A couple of things. One, let's just be really clear about the facts. It is not the case that Antifa only mobilizes against white supremacists and Nazis. So anybody who's telling you that they're in the streets only against white supremacists and Nazis doesn't know anything about Antifa. I mean, as we have seen from Portland, we've seen in D.C., we've seen in Berkeley. We have seen them time and again mobilize to shut down free speech, sometimes pretty mundane and regular free speech, like the presence of a GOP float in a parade in Portland, that they were going to use violence to disrupt a parade to keep a Republican Party float from being in a parade. I mean, that's not mobilizing against Nazis. So these guys, the fascists that they mobilize against, they have an extraordinarily broad definition, extraordinarily. And then the second thing is, the idea that these guys are only acting in self-defense is belied by fact after fact after fact. I mean, you know, there was a very prominent arrest in Berkeley of an adjunct professor, I believe, who hit a guy with a bike lock. They were yelling. There was an argument going on. And you see very clearly from the video that he moves in and from the crowd and strikes a guy in the head with a bike lock, which could have killed him. I mean, it's just, they're just fortunate so far that some of their violent acts haven't resulted in death. And in their videos, again, you will see like a woman in a MAGA hat, a young girl in a MAGA hat, or a Trump supporter giving an interview on television. And in comes a person from Antifa and pepper sprays her right in the face. That's not defending anybody. So again and again and again, the facts are just completely against their claims that they're essentially this vanguard defending against Nazi violence. They're just violent vigilante thugs who will attack and strike and hit and assault and beat anybody they don't like. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is, look, I recognize that there are times when violence or the threat of violence is necessary to preserve liberty. But you know what? That's the police's job. The police exist to preserve liberty. The police exist to ensure the safety of marchers. The police exist to separate two sides and prevent violence from flaring up. It is not the job of vigilante gangs to roam around beating whomever they want to beat and then claim and then retreat behind the mantle of, well, we're just protecting the nonviolent. That's just fundamentally not how civil society works. But that brings us to a related point in a piece I wrote today. If we want less blood in the streets, and we do, we need less blood in the streets because this nation is increasingly a tinderbox. We got to have that thin blue line step up. We got to have the police step up. And what's very unfortunate is we have seen in places like Berkeley, we saw in Charlottesville, one of the only things you'll get the alt-right and Antifa to agree on, an awful lot of times the police are either not present when a lot of these attacks are happening, or they're actually standing and watching rather than intervening. And that's, we can't have that. That's unacceptable. That creates an environment that fuels more violence because people, A, think that they can get away with it, and B, believe that they have to be violent in an act of self-defense. And we can't have that. That's that. We've got to have the police step up. We just have to. And a police force that isn't protecting our liberty is a police force that's failing.
And as David mentioned, he did just write on that. It's on the homepage of National Review Online if you want to read the entire piece. So, David, let's jump off to our third and final crazy martini today. And it's also a jump off from where we were earlier in the week when inevitably the what should happen to the Civil War era monuments, particularly from the Confederacy, what should happen to them? We've already seen some of them removed. The most recent one, Roger Taney being removed from the State House in Annapolis. I'm not sure too many tears are going to be shed about that one.
No.
He, of course, was the Chief Justice who wrote the horrific Dred Scott decision in 1857. But then, of course, the larger debate reigns. The president jumped in on Twitter yesterday talking about it and so forth. And so the debate rages on. But as we talked about a couple of days ago, your solution, and I think it's one I agree with, is that there should be more examples of history, not less. Put up statues of Union figures in the South or slaves or free men who were black who made significant sacrifices or did heroic things to fully fill in the picture of what happened during the Civil War. We also said if you start ripping them all out, where does it stop, perhaps? And Trump picked up on that as well, because, of course, some of our founding fathers, many of our founding fathers, were slaveholders, including the likes of George Washington and Thomas Jefferson. And before long, some folks might be calling for that. Well, before long didn't take too long, David, because Angela Rye is a CNN contributor. She was on a panel on CNN on Thursday, where the point CNN was trying to make, I think, was that there is a difference between the founding fathers and the Confederate leaders. I think CNN's editorial position is generally that most of them should be moved. But here's Angela Rye disputing that there should be a different standard for Washington and Jefferson.
I think that we have to get to the heart of the problem here, and the heart of the problem is the way in which many of us were taught American history. American history is not all glorious, and even though I love John to death, I couldn't disagree more about George Washington. George Washington was a slave owner, and we need to call slave owners out for what they are. Whether we think they were protecting American freedom or not, he wasn't protecting my freedom. I wasn't someone who my ancestors weren't deemed human beings to him. And so to me, I don't care if it's a George Washington statue or a Thomas Jefferson statue or a Robert E. Lee statue. They all need to come down.
David, as folks like to say on Twitter, boy, that escalated quickly.
Yeah, yes, that certainly did. I mean, gotta love a Ron Burgundy reference there. But yeah, I mean, this is so predictable. And first, can we just deal with a little bit of a straw man here? Maybe at one point in American history, it was the case that school kids were brought up believing only the most glorious things about our country. But that's long over. The opposite is, in fact, the biggest problem that we have. Our kids are taught, and if you look at school books in public schools, if you look at instruction in universities, our kids are taught a lot more negative things about the United States than positive things nowadays. And so this sort of idea that, you know, we've got to wake people up. No, you know what we do? We do have to wake people up. We have to wake people up about the good things about America. That's what we have to do. But so that's just an aside. As for the rest of this, I mean, you know, look, what this does is it's exposing a will to power. It's exposing the desire to completely control the way in which the American story is told and to completely control the naming of heroes and villains, to completely control our understanding of our founding fathers. I mean, this is just sheer will to power kind of stuff. And look, I'm not sitting there saying that this person's sitting there going, you know, I'm Machiavellian, but this is the fundamental reality of it. It's a power move, and it's a power move with a very real purpose and a very negative purpose. This is something that we talked about early in the week. Whenever I'm hearing the argument about removal of statues, one of my first questions is, what's the principle here? What's the argument? What's the overall argument? What's the overall principle in play? And some folks, including some folks at National Review, I think would say, well, the principle is if you were a secessionist, if you were somebody who actually fought for the dissolution of this country, that makes you a very different person from a George Washington and a Thomas Jefferson. And yeah, certainly I would agree with that. And that would be the line. But that's not really the left's line here. That's not the line that the left is trying to draw. It's essentially trying to create for itself a blanket power to determine across the United States who should be honored. according to ever-shifting standards of social justice and intersectionality. And that's I think that's the reality of the movement that we confront. I do not think that the movement that has all the energy is one that's simply saying we're going to draw a line about Confederates and Confederates only. I think the real movement that exists out there is one that's motivated by intersectionality, by left-wing identity politics, and it doesn't have limiting principles. And that's what I'm concerned about. And also, you know, I would say even for my friends at Nash Review who are in favor of removing Confederate monuments, I think that's a line that doesn't take each monument as it is. And the monuments around the South are erected for different reasons. They're not all erected for the same reason. They're not all they don't all honor the same people. They don't all weren't all motivated by the same things. And so I think that there's a real danger in sweeping everything into a single category. Like I said, I think I would apply the same standards that I tend to apply for free speech. The cure for bad speech is better speech. The cure for bad speech is more speech. So I would say the cure for history you think that is taught as flawed or one-sided is teach it more completely and better.
David, finishing strong. Well done, sir. It's been a very taxing week, but it's been a fascinating week, and I'm glad we had a chance to talk about the major events throughout it. Thanks very much for your time, and we'll talk to you down the road.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me.
David French of National Review in for Jim Garrity this week. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Jim will return on Monday. Please join us then for the next 3 Martini Lunch. Have a great weekend, everybody.